Welcome to this episode of George Dog Days of Bummer, your only podcast for George Lopez breakdowns, episode by episode. I'm one of your hosts, Kyle Overkill, joined by my favorite Lopez lover, Tim. How you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. Trying to keep an eye on the Bruins game. Currently winning 4-1 against the Penguins. I'm in a good mood right now.
Yeah, we'll see. Like Tim flip his fucking computer. We'll know it's not going well. But I'm glad you're in a good mood, Tim, because I got some bad news, buddy.
Gonna bring me down again?
Yeah, and it's really awkward because I know we were gonna do our first live episode breaking down the George Lopez show today. We were gonna talk about the episode where after refusing Benny's plea for a new car, when Bobby bribes Carmen to bring her to a bar, George and Annie are forced to drive Benny around. We actually have a really good and exciting episode. And I mean, it's awkward because you can see him. I apologize, Zach, but we have a really good episode. We're going to be talking to Zach Thompson, creator of I Breath the Body. How would you say it? I was thinking that I've never said it out loud.
I Breathe the Body, starring George Lopez, I think is the full title.
Yeah. It's a true body horror scenario. But, yes, we're doing this. If you're listening, we're trying out some live one. We've done some previous ones like end of the year or just kind of like book of the month type stuff. But it has worked out because the issue came out last week. I mean, I'm always interested. Because a lot of times we're talking about books before they come out so we can try and like coordinate when episodes drop. I'm always interested, especially someone who's had, you know, a lot of indie stuff, but then also, I mean, you've been able to do a lot of the X-Men stuff, especially with kind of Lonnie. How's it then kind of returning to like the self? I mean, you don't really take a break from it, but like, what's a release like that where it's like kind of you just doing it and putting it out there, especially because, I mean, Aftershock is great, but like, it's always like you pushing stuff a lot on your own and really getting that. Like, how are releases for you, like doing X-Men versus like something like this where it's kind of like your baby?
I mean, it's like night and day, honestly. Like with like creator owned stuff, you're banging your own drum very much so. And you're doing it for months at a time, slowly sort of doling out information. And like doing a Marvel book is very much the opposite, where you sort of aren't allowed to give anything away, other than usually just the cover. And so you sort of are shrouded in secrecy for a really long time. And those books, for better or worse, kind of come with preconceptions about what they may be or who they're for or whatever. So you're fighting an uphill battle sometimes when you're releasing that kind of stuff. Whereas like with something like this, I can control the messaging and I can kind of speak to people who specifically might be looking for something like this. So it's like a lot easier to kind of go like, hey, do you love Clive Barker and David Cronenberg? Well, this is something you're going to really dig. And I've seen like a real demonstrable difference from like my pre-Marvel creator-owned stuff to my post-Marvel creator-owned stuff, where like there's just a bigger audience who is aware that I exist. And with horror in specific, people just get so devoted to that kind of thing. So it's really easy to kind of speak to that community because I've been like part of it for about 10 years. So like, it's honestly night and day, and I love creator owned for that reason. It's just so freeing, and there's so much more, you just get to experience a lot more joy when your books are successful. Whereas like with Marvel, you kind of always feel like you're a little bit removed from it. Even when they are successful, you're sort of just like, oh, well, I hope they give me more work, and sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't.
Well, especially, I mean, I imagine it's kind of like with the X-Men, you kind of have to pitch, you know, this is my take on X-Men, or this is my story with the Marauder or something like that, versus like, here's my take on like Cronenberg body horror meets social media. And like, there's a whole different, like, here's like a whole genre that I can sell you versus like, here's how I'm going to make X-Men or not, like Cyclops, not a dick or something, versus something else.
Yeah. And there's a lot more just like ownership over this kind of stuff, where it's also just allowing me to kind of like do the things that I feel like I'm best at, which, you know, you're always encouraged to do your best work at Marvel, but you're still within that, those confines of that sandbox where there's very clear walls that you run up against just on certain things. Like, you know, you might have a story beat that works perfectly and then someone else ends up doing it a month before and you didn't know. And then you have to kind of like rebuild your story like on the fly because of something that just didn't get communicated to you or whatever. So yeah, there's just a way better ability to sort of succeed when you control most of it because you can speak about it passionately and you can do your best work.
That's and I'm always amazed that you got like you and Lonnie kind of ended up on X-Men, because I feel like if there was any, I mean, outside of Hulk, which we've kind of seen with the Immortal Hulk, like I would love to see like the X-Men dip into horror, especially like body horror. Like you feel like they would be like ripe for that. And I know they kind of tried to like, you know, I feel like New Mutants, I thought was okay. Like in that kind of like realm of like dipping into horror, like I feel like they would be like, you know, perfectly ripe for like horror. And like having you and like Lonnie already on, it's like someone fuck, like let them do like sprinkle it in.
Truly, I mean, like that was sort of what we got away with our Cable book, and in a lot of ways, we got to do a little bit of body horror and crazy sort of techno-organic virus-based stuff for five issues. But that was mostly because they didn't know who we were and didn't care about that book, so they're just like, go wild, like just do your thing, like, you know. And then like I think because we were allowed to sort of play to our strengths, that's actually kind of what opened the door to getting more work at Marvel, because they were just like, oh, you guys like actually know what you're doing.
For, I feel like I Breathe a Body is one of, is that your best title? Is that, is there anything going to beat that title?
Oh, you mean like in terms of just like being a mouthful? It's so or? Fucking, and...
It's so fucking good. Like it's, it like encapsulates it, but like, it's also like, I don't know, like it, it's so vague and it like, it just, it gets you ready for it. And like, it's so phrased well, I don't know. It's, I, everything you've done, like Lonely Receiver is really good. I feel like you've nailed titles, which
I spend a lot of fucking time on titles, honestly. And they change quite a bit, usually through the genesis of the project. Like, so like sometimes what I end up pitching as a title doesn't actually end up being the final book's title. I Breathe the Body's one that actually stayed where it was, but that was because I'd been developing the book for like probably 4 years before it got like moved into production.
Yeah, and you've talked about kind of the genesis of it, like sitting in the room. I mean, for anyone that doesn't know, it was like sitting in the room when you were at a company and they were, you guys were pitching to work with Logan Paul. And it was like right after the Suicide Force video, kind of the existential horror that happened around that moment, which is really interesting because in this first issue, obviously, you kind of delve directly into that. Like, you throw that scenario right in there in, like, the fourth page. Was that kind of always something you wanted to do? Obviously, kind of the idea and how it branched out into the larger story, but, like, kind of really throwing your own experiences into it to really like ground it, because I feel like that's the selling point for Annie, or at least kind of where you're brought into her is that kind of conversation and the like moral conundrum that's brought upon her.
Yeah, and I think that was a really important thing for me, because like I secret working with influencers fucking sucks, is a nightmare. They're mostly just children who grew up on I'm speaking in wide platitudes, but for the most part, the people that I worked with that were like upper echelon of influencers were people who didn't actually understand sort of the gravity of their relationship to their fans or what it meant to sort of have an audience, that kind of thing. So there was a lot of ignorance at play every day that I kind of felt like the only adult in the room a lot of times, where I was like, you can't say that, or you can't do that. Like, we can't have you talking about gun violence and then like being like, but the person was right to bring a gun in there or whatever. Like, just stupid things like that, that would seem like common sense, but are blind spots, because influencers sort of are, once they break through and they have an audience, all they get told is yes all the time. And my job was basically to tell people no and deal with these like really weird moral conundrums. So I was like, I want to throw people into the deep end right away. And kind of also for anyone who's like worked in advertising or anyone who's worked in journalism or anything like that, show them that I know what I'm talking about as well, because I think that that was a thing that, like, you know, if I was on the other side of this and I heard this book get announced, I would have immediately rolled my eyes and been like, yeah, right. Like, it probably won't be that interesting because you don't know anything about what you're talking about. And for me, like, I really want it to be written for the 1% of people who have been in that world and understand that world. And like, I actually had to fight sometimes with Aftershock for keeping certain terminology and stuff in the book, because they were like, well, let's make it more accessible. Let's kind of bring it a little bit out of this world. And I was like, no. Like, that's what grounds this. That's the anchor to this stuff, because I want people to like learn about the mechanics of how this deception works, or how you build these people into these things that deceive other people. And it's really important to me that like, we don't pull our punches, so to speak.
Right. And I feel like, I mean, generally in horror and or even comics, like, I mean, that's something me and Tim generally enjoy a lot, is you get, and even more so kind of in like the sci-fi, and you've worked a lot in that as well. Like, I would much rather have to take the time to invest, figure it out, or even if I don't generally understand it, like, okay, like, you can get the general picture. I'd much rather that than kind of it peeled back and be like the lesser version of something when I'm reading it. Like, I feel like a lot of times that is something where taking readers, especially comic readers, like, you don't necessarily, like, I don't have to necessarily understand everything, as long as I get the feeling or know that you understand it as the writer. And like, if you're telling me you're the expert on it, so like, kind of tell me the story, versus like, I don't need a story told to me. I need like a story that I can read and like being told by a person.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of handholding in comics in general that I'm not a big fan of personally. Like, I'll go to publishers and be like, I don't write comics for everyone. Sorry, like, my comics are just not for everyone. And like, I feel like that shouldn't be a controversial statement, right? Like, there are audiences for certain things, and I'm aware that I write stuff for specific niche audiences. But my hope is that by, you know, doing a weird Cronenbergian fungal horror crazy shit, but tying it to like the ethics of social media, you do actually create like less of a barrier for entry to people, because they're like, oh, you know what? Like, I just saw the Capitol get raided 3 weeks ago. And like, I've always wondered what QAnon was, or the mechanics of how something like that works. So like, I'm intrigued by, you know, social media being used to propagate like the voyeurism of violence or whatever it may be. But like, I think there's a conduit there for people to connect it to their own personal relationship with these things. And that's the sort of part that I feel like is broader. And then if I can pull you in and kind of show you this crazy world, hell yeah. But like, yeah, I don't know. It's just, this sort of stuff is hard, but I also just really want people to like, feel like they can get their, I was going to say smiles and scares. So you can get your smiles from like learning, and you can get your scares from the other crazy shit.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for a long time, even sci-fi as well, I was listening to, what's that guy's name? Christopher Pollini. He wrote that recently, the Sleep and Sea of Stars or something.
Okay.
Which is like a sci-fi horror type thing. And he was talking about, he wrote the Aragon series or something. But like, he was talking about being kind of like pigeonholed as like a sci-fi fantasy writer. And like the idea that like that for him would essentially be fine, because sci-fi, much like horror, and I think that's why you see those two together so much, are genres that can literally tell any story they want. Like, you could tell, you know, a horror romance, you could tell a horror comedy, and like, horror and like sci-fi is such a good kind of like entryway or kind of like wraparound genre to tell any distinct story. And I think you do that specifically a lot with horror, and kind of tackling not only societal issues, but kind of like deeper personal stuff, like stuff with like Lonely Receiver, but then like The Dregs, which was like, again, a social commentary and kind of like that. And you can do so in a way where you're not like overtly assaulting someone who might be like upset by that type of stuff. And you can kind of like, or just like turned off on it, you can kind of lull them in and then go like, they'll can go go and be like, I enjoy this horror. Oh shit. Like that kind of makes sense. I can see those two together. Even thing like, you know, the dregs, and then kind of see what's happened recently with Reddit and GameStop, and like, and kind of like the uproar of like, you know, fuck the right. Like you, we can fucking do shit to these people. And like, to be able to kind of get people into that through scaring them, or, you know, bringing them to another sci-fi world, is like what those genres do best.
Yeah, and I often joke that it's like tricking people into thinking about complex issues through like using genre as a lens rather than sort of like a limiting factor. It's like, to me, a lot of this stuff, I didn't really know what my philosophy was on it whenever I created the dregs, but I can kind of see this through line in a lot of my work now, where it's like using metaphor to talk about things that are more complex societal issues. Usually the metaphor is something that is like grounded in something real, but elevated, like a restaurant serving homeless people. And the metaphor being that like our modern cities are literally consuming houseless folks and really like, you know, building industries off of the backs of people who need to be housed, and prioritizing all of the wrong things. But like, you don't really want to read a comic book and get into like the ethics of that kind of stuff, because then it starts to feel like you're going to like a community board meeting or whatever, even though there's one of those in the book. but like the idea being that you wrap it up in this, like, you know, you see a homeless man get ground up and turned into sausages, and then on page five, he's served to a ritzy group of people. Like, you understand that metaphor right then and there, and then you can kind of just jump into the genre shit, and like that framing device is there. And I think that's sort of like, now that I'm looking back on it and seeing sort of the patterns after making like 5, 6, 7 series, that's sort of like the DNA of a lot of stuff. I go like, oh, I'm really pissed off about this specific thing in society, and like, I'm not going to go on Twitter and rant about it. So how do I figure out how to like wrap this up in a complex sort of, usually a visual metaphor, and then sort of like blending genres a lot. So like, you know, you could call I Breathe the Body just a straight up sci-fi book and with horror moments, and you'd be right. You could also call it a straight up horror book with sci-fi moments, and you'd be right. And I like that sort of stuff that kind of slithers between genres, because that's sort of what comic books have been for as long as they've existed, right? There's that genre blending. And I think that like, as a medium, they're typically 5 or 6 years ahead of some of the cultural conversations that we're having. So there's a lot of stuff that you can talk about in comics before, like you could even pitch it to like a prose publisher, for example.
Right. For something like I Breathe the Body, which I think like in the beginning, especially kind of how you open the issue with that visceral scene and a little more, and you've kind of teased it, or at least it's been brought up, like kind of the Cronenbergian stuff. And like, I think a lot of that as the body horror. And I think a lot of your stuff, you kind of play with that element, and it being something I think that works well in comics, that kind of visceral element that you can get with comics, where you oftentimes, something me and Tim talk about a lot about is you can't like control pacing and stuff like that. Like comics, you really kind of lose that because the reader can turn the page, like they can see it, they can like, so I think you play a lot with like the visuals and kind of skewing that. How do you like, what do you think is like good body horror in that sense? Like obviously like there's like kind of like, I feel like again that's like a tight, like horror in itself is already like kind of a tightrope walking. I think body horror is like even like you're like tightening the rope even more, because it could either just be like gross, but then there's the ability to kind of like get that visceral reaction. Like, and I feel like you do that extremely well. I always think of that, like that final issue of Lonely Receiver with like the needle in the eye and kind of like the splitting and like the tearing of skin, like to be able to kind of really, cause like you can internalize that versus like just like seeing someone get their arm cut off isn't necessarily always something that sticks with you. Like, how do you effectively approach that?
I think a lot of it, like, so, there's like two aspects to it. Like my general approach to horror is sort of like looking at it like a descent. So sort of like the first issue is always sort of this surface level, and as you proceed deeper, the character sort of just keeps getting more and more like wrapped up in the shit that's unavoidable, to the point like when you get to the end, you're literally sort of cornered there with them and forced to confront it. And I think that body horror specifically, when done well, kind of evokes that idea of like a virus infecting you or something that is slowly sort of seeping into your consciousness and building in the background, festering almost. And I think that there's like, there's that body horror where it's like, oh, someone gets their hand cut off and then like they're spraying blood or whatever. And it's like, I don't even see that really personally as body horror. I see that more as just like splatter or gore or whatever, torture porn. But like, I think there's something interesting about the sustained sort of degeneration of form, and how that relates to the degeneration of your mind. So like specifically, I think really good body horror does that interplay between like, I'm losing my mind, but it's partly because this thing that I've trusted to be like finite and dependable in my life is now breaking down in these ways that are unfamiliar to me. So instead of like a killer running behind you, it's like, I literally can't trust my body to do the things that I have every single day for my whole life. And now that is a deeply unsettling and alien experience where I don't recognize my own form anymore. And, you know, like, not to get too heavy, but like, when I was growing up, my dad suffered a massive stroke when I was 7. And so like, I spent a lot of time in the hospital with him, sort of seeing his body completely degenerated and sort of like having to learn how to walk again and talk again. And that sort of stuff, I didn't even connect to my lifelong love of body horror. And then sort of like, as I got older and kept returning to it, I was like, what the fuck is wrong with me? Like, why is that something that I can't scratch that itch? And I think it was really that. I think it was like living in the hospital and seeing like that kind of imagery all the time of people like working really, really hard to sort of rebuild themselves or rebuild trust in this, this essentially your like your flesh construct and trying to like work it back into something that you can trust again, I think is such an interesting concept, because that's like, that's something we can all share a fear in, right? Like, you know, I would be terrified to like lose my legs. How do you rebuild your life? Like, that causes all these kind of crazy logistical questions about what happens next and how do you sort of go forward? And I don't know. I thought for sure that after I wrote like one or two body horror things, I would be like done with the theme. And what I've realized is that like, you know, the last issue of a book or the final page is kind of an arbitrary end to a lifelong obsession. So I can continue to kind of mind these things for a really long time. And I also like, you know, not to be too snooty, but I feel like a lot of body horror is not done well. I feel like a lot of people fuck it up. And I think there's a lot of evidence in like the work of David Cronenberg, to go back to him and study his work. There's a lot of really good rules of thumb to follow from that a lot of people don't follow, because they look at the thing and they're like, that's body horror. And it is, but if you go that big all the time, you don't have anywhere to go. And that comes back to like that descent thing of like, start small and build slowly.
Right. Well, yeah, I think, and especially kind of like the thing or something like I think in our minds, we always jump to that big moment, which obviously works. That works because it was built upon throughout that movie and then pushing into it. And like, I feel like where body horror works very much, well, it's kind of like we're talking about like the lens of horror, and something we were talking about with like last year was, I thought like the Lola Woods was a really good horror story, and it was able to kind of present a scenario and understanding that as like a white male, I couldn't necessarily understand, but filtered through the lens of horror and this question of choice and like memory and all that stuff, and presenting it in that horror way, like I was able to at least empathize. I can always empathize, but like I was able to kind of feel it through the way of horror, and much kind of like with body horror, everyone has a body and everyone can kind of imagine what it feels like to have like your eye plucked out or something like that. And like, you can, if you can then filter that through a moment and an idea, then you can kind of like really draw people in. And I think, again, that's where comics work so well, is it, like we talked about, like Blunch, like, you know, movies, you have the element of music and cutting and camera angles, and, you know, prose, you can really kind of play with people's imagination. And in comics, you're kind of like at a crossroads with those two. So to kind of be able to play upon elements that really drive people in, whether it be characters or those like horror elements, like, is kind of where you have to really, I think, focus. And again, like speaking with your work, I think that's like for you. And then anytime you've been with Lonnie, like, I've exceeded beyond like pale.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I mean, like, Lonnie and I have lots of conversations about the language of comics and how to pace things specifically, and sort of how to make things particularly painful. Like, there's little things, like, I always think about, like, in my head, it's like, you know, in comics, you can do a thing where, like, you can have someone's face get ripped off. You know, spoilers, I guess, for Hybrid the Body. But there's also, like, I think the intimacy of certain things where it's like, you can show a splinter go under someone's fingernail, and that could equally fuck someone up, because they're just like, oh, like, ah, because you just, you feel it, but you can get a reader there by slowly, you know, showing a finger close to something for the majority of an issue, and then that thing kind of like going in underneath the fingernail or whatever, and like just be so killer because of the intimacy of that. And I think that that's something that you just hit, like that relatability of stuff, where you can kind of like, you can connect to it immediately. And I try a lot to think about how do you mix that reliability with unreliability, like what we're looking at here with like that, those meat husks, those look fucked up for a reason. And they're weird and alien. And I love that kind of stuff about horror, is like putting these weird, like dreadful images in that, like, there's no explanation, there's no words on the page, and you're not going to get an answer to that until a couple issues later. But building those things in, so there's this like creeping, unsettling dread of like just these questions that you're asking yourself of like, how did this world get this way? What the hell are they eating? What the hell was the thing we saw on the first couple pages? That kind of stuff. I think there's a lot of tension to be derived from that too. And like in a normal book, I feel like you would spend 5 or 6 pages explaining all of that shit and then getting into the story. And I'm just so not a fan of that. I really like throwing people in and then like going like, people will be more compelled to read this going forward because they have questions about how this stuff comes together. But if I front load it, you're going to be bored by the time you get to page 6. And then you're not going to care about all these cool little things that I hit everywhere. So, but yeah, I think that's changed for me.
I think that kind of, that just like set dressing and like atmosphere and tone, it reminds me, I guess, more extreme side, like Mike Mignola, because he'll just put like a panel with like a gargoyle and like it's not relevant to the story, but it's just, it helps set the mood. And so it's just kind of like this weird meat. It's just, it's more background and atmospheric than anything.
Yeah. And tone is so important in horror, is establishing the right tone of like just creating this unsettling undercurrent that continues to get a little bit more unsettling with each subsequent issue, to the point where like, and like I saw that in real time with Lonely Receiver, where like people continued, as issues came out, they were like, oh my God, what the fuck is going on here? And I'm just sitting there like waiting, because I knew what the last two issues were. And I was like, if you guys thought that was crazy, like I was just, Jen and I were both just so excited, because we had so many conversations about like keeping the first three issues as like relatively grounded, and then sort of like ripping the rug out from under people as you got deeper into the world, and, you know, rewarding those who stayed with the book for that long as well, because comics is this way of like, well, I read the first two, but I didn't feel super compelled to keep going. And so like, if you strike that tone properly, I think you can really kind of create this like weird, strange embrace with people where they're like, I don't even know why I'm reading this book, but I just need to know where it's going. And like, that's my favorite.
All Right. And when I think of like, that's like a huge criticism a lot of time about horror, or like, I mean, like, obviously, like, kind of the joke with Stephen King is like, he doesn't always land endings. And a lot of times, I think, like, when he doesn't, it's because he's front loading it. And obviously, like, if you have a 900 page book, like, there's only so much like tension you can draw out of that. But like, that's kind of like key. And like, I can think of so many times where I'm like halfway through a novel and I'm like, this is already like, the peak has already happened. Like, I don't know, either it's going to get really good, which I doubt it, or it's just kind of like going to peter out. And like, it's still an okay experience, but like, trying to think of something recent, like The Fisherman or something like that, where like, it kind of peaks at the end. And that's what I want. Like, I want the final page or the final like 10 pages to be like the climax in the experience. Whereas like, you know, if you show me the monster right away, that's cool, but there's got to be something else to it. If not, then like, I'm just like kind of like forcing myself along. And I think a lot of times, like, that's kind of where horror stumbles. I mean, anything, like, you could, like, any plot wise or comedy, but like, especially horror, where it's all about building the tension and building that up. And like, if you kind of break it at some point, you're not able to come back from it. Like, you've really lost a lot of people. And I think that's where the like endings are a lot of times ruined.
Yeah, and I think like the thing I keep thinking about a lot with horror is restraint, like exercising the adequate level of restraint to, like, you know, be sure that you're not kind of like, for lack of a better way or a more eloquent way to explain it, blowing your load early. and that like you really want people to sort of feel like they're like, where is this going? How is this going to resolve? And then, like, you know, in the last 10 minutes, 10 pages, or last chapter, or whatever it may be, there's this like sustained sort of relief where you're like, oh my God, that's what it all is. But it's also super overwhelming because there's just so much sort of coming to a crescendo all at the same time. Like, I think about the end of Robert Eggers' Witch, where like the final shot of that is like burnt into my mind because there is all this dread and there's this sustained suspense about what the hell's going on. And then you get to that ending and it's like, you don't necessarily get a ton of answers, but what you do get is a very satisfying, like, or at least in my opinion, resolution to what that was building towards. And it's like, I would have liked for it to go even further personally, but I still love that final image. And I think that that's equally powerful as making sure that your book ends on an image that is memorable and also evokes the sort of like, it feels like it's earned that sustained suspense. And like, I spent a really long time with I Breathe the Body going like, I knew kind of what the last five pages were, and like, I scripted it out actually first thing, like with issue five, and then sort of reverse engineered my way back to that because I was like, I want this to be like one sustained moment of like relief, but like thematic resonance and this huge gut punch. And it's like, you know, no matter what, no one's gonna have any idea how this book ends or what the point of this is or what it's trying to say. But like, it's gonna be cool because it's gonna hit people over the back of the head, I think, in a very interesting way, because it's all there and you'll be able to like read it back a second time and see exactly what was coming. But we've gone out of our way to make sure it's pretty hard to do it, at least your first time through.
Right. And I think like kind of with that, or even like kind of the witch analogy, like the end of that movie, you get a resolution to at least the story, like the story that's told in that movie. Like, you may not find out like the history of the witch. You may not find out like what, like, and obviously like those questions, like I would like, you know, four movies about explaining like this whole backstory of all this stuff, and that'd be interesting. But like, as long as you get the resolution of the story you're trying to tell, like, ultimately that's what, and that, and like, I like at the end of something having questions, like it's okay, because then again, like, I can play with that in my own head and I can do that. But again, I got a resolution to the story. And again, I think that's something you guys have done really well. You specifically, I think of, again, I think Lonely Receiver is something where it had a resolution to the story and there was more about that world and that's that larger thing. But like, at least that like was a contained thing, and you got your questions answered in that sense, but there was still like kind of bigger philosophical questions, stuff like that. One thing I think tackling with horror as well, this is like stuff you've done in other stuff, but specifically in this is the kind of tech end of things. And that's been like kind of a new thing with horror is like, I think people like, you know, how am I going to tackle this now that I have everyone a cell phone and everyone just like loses service and all that stuff. But like, there's people who are actively kind of merging that in there. And like, I mean, the rote answer is like, you know, Black Mirror or something like that. But like, kind of tackling that for you, like, how was that? I think cause you've done a lot with it. And I think, again, kind of living in that world previously in your work, but also kind of just the nature of writing comics nowadays and the nature we're living in, like, we're just kind of forced into that. Has that been easy for you to kind of just kind of adapt the horror to that, less like it being a part of the horror, but more the horror coming from the idea of the technology and the world we live in, and specifically with like I Breathe the Body, kind of how the internet is this organism and how it's affecting that kind of larger story there?
Yeah, I mean, like, to be perfectly honest, for probably the first like 6 or 7 years that I wrote, I went out of my way to not have technology and stuff because I used to fucking hate, you know, you're watching a slasher and someone's like, I don't have cell reception. What am I going to do? And you're like, what? Like, it doesn't just magically happen when it needs it to happen. And so I think a lot of times people avoid working technology in because of the problems that it presents, which is fair enough. But my solution, I guess, lately, and sort of as I sort of view my work going forward, I think is to sort of take these things and immediately what is familiar about them, just make it alien and remove that relationship that we have. So you still have that sort of emotional response when you see someone on their phone, you understand what that means. You understand, like, when Anne posts a selfie in the first issue of I Breathe the Body, you understand, you know, what that means. And colloquially, like, we know what it's like to go through that. But what you don't understand is, like, then her fucking phone flies away like a bug and has like wings on the back of it. And I talked to Andy specifically about this at the beginning, where I was like, look, man, like, this is a book about influencers. This is a book about YouTube and Facebook, but like, we're not going to see any of that shit in here because you and I, like, you know, you can go on the bus and see someone on their iPhone and it's like, you see it everywhere. You see it yourself doing it. And that's just boring to draw, to read everything about it. Just sort of doesn't interest me. But what does interest me is like using those things as metaphors to explore other things. And also, again, like a tonal thing is like it inspires a level of dread when you look at something like that that doesn't make sense. And you're like, what the hell is that? Why are they all super chill with that? And I think that there's something inherent that you get from that you wouldn't otherwise. And I think that that's something that I'm really intrigued in exploring as like a central metaphor in some of my tech-based horror stuff is built out of that idea of like, we have these like intimate feelings about phones and the devices that we use and that we feel like we understand them through and through. But I feel like most people who use their phones or use social media don't actually fully understand what's happening to them or what's happening with the information that they sort of put out into the world on those things and how much the devices that we use end up using us. And I think that that's sort of a thing that, like, in my mind, we are going to continue to sort of experience the fallout of that for the next 10, 15 years. And all I'm trying to do is go, here's what I'm anxious about, and I'm going to make it a horror book now.
Is that something? One of the most interesting things about the book is kind of, we've talked about it in interviews leading up to the book, was tying in the internet itself as this like organism or this entity. And like, again, I think that's something like inherently people just don't like understand what people know what the internet is, but no one will ever like people, the general public don't know what the internet is. Like, there's no, like, I can look at pictures on it and I can watch porn. Like, I can do these things on it. I don't know what it is. I don't know what it connects to. And you've kind of tied that to the idea of the mushrooms and like kind of the fungal aspects of that. And like, the already interesting like making up of like what a mushroom is and like the kind of the like weirdness of that. Like, was that something, how did that come like into the element of the book? Like, I'm the idea of like kind of the social aspect and like the horror behind that, and then also breeding it with this, like, I guess, well, like that final image of the book is probably the most unsettling thing in the book, which it's already full of like unsettling things, but like that shit was fucked up. And like, I had just read The Ruins, the Scott Smith book, I think, and like the talking plant and that, and so like I literally just finished that last night and I was rereading this and I'm like, oh fuck, I fucking hate so like, how did that kind of like connection, neural connection happen in your brain to tie the internet to like this like fungal mushroom world?
I mean, there's like a simple answer and then there's a more complex. So I'll just start with the simple one, which is I was working on No One's Rose at the time that I was pitching this book. No One's Rose has like a fungal metropolis in it. Had done a bunch of research about mushrooms. And at the same time, I was pitching I Breathe the Body. And what happened is I Breathe the Body got approved, and it was approved as like sort of like a modern day story. And like, I knew through and through that it wasn't going to be, and that I wanted to put it into the far future. But I also understand that like certain things make publishers trip up. So it's better to sort of not lead with, I want this to be a complex metaphor about mushrooms and the internet at the same time. So what happened is once the book was approved, I sort of presented my case, which was essentially like, based on my research in mushrooms, they work on vast, complex networks. Mycelium and mushrooms in general will be probably, from at least the research that I've done, at the forefront of some technological breakthroughs going forward. They are simply just not fully understood, but their versatility and the way that they can especially clean up waste is going to be a huge part of just climate change efforts. I truly believe that. But beyond that, I think that mushrooms exist in this strange liminal space. Some of them are alive, some of them are dead. And that network itself was an easy way to sort of tie it to the internet and be like, okay, let's make this decentralized internet, sort of push us into the future after all of these social networks have failed. But then as we get deeper into the book, we also see that like some of the characters find themselves within this liminal space where they don't quite understand who they're presenting themselves as and who they actually are. And you see a little bit of that in the first issue, but I really wanted to get into how does the internet sort of make us kind of diverge internally. That's something that I've been feeling a lot lately as my sort of social media facing personality has been growing from releasing books and that kind of stuff. The person I am online is not necessarily the person I am in my private life. And how do you draw that distinction? And a lot of people, again, I don't think make that assessment of influencers and that kind of thing. So I really wanted to make that a theme within the book. So mushrooms exist as that metaphor. But then on top of it, I just really wanted to show people something that is familiar and then teach them how strange it is, because I feel like, as you said, the internet is familiar to us, but as you dig deeper, it's a very strange thing. It works in very strange ways, and it guides our behavior in very strange ways. And we want to think of it as this like altruistic, objective thing, but there's a lot of people with a lot of money manipulating how information moves, as we saw with like the Wall Street Bets shit that's going on this week. It's if you understand it and you understand how things work, you can mobilize, you can change things, you can quote unquote like rewrite the rules of reality. And I think that that was something that like I was really intrigued in, and also felt like no one was really talking about, especially in comics. So I was like, yoink.
I think like the whole Wall Street thing this week was like kind of the understanding again of you know, these systems exist much like the internet. Like the whole idea of what is it, short trading, like it's just a fucking like high concept thing that like people have used to ostensibly like, you know, make money and fuck other people. And like, all it took was like someone like this, you know, this mobilization of Redditors to figure out like, here's how we can break down that system and use it and really like fuck this hedge firm and like doing it. And like, again, I saw so much, like most of that story was like people saying like, I don't understand what this story is. And like, it was because like, it's a system that was created to like literally like exist that. So like, you know, no, quote unquote, like normal people don't know what it is. Like the idea of money and stocks and stuff like that. And like, that whole thing is so foreign to people. And people are just like, yeah, it is what it is. People know how to do it and they make money. And like, no, like same with the internet, like that shit exists because like it makes money for other people. And like, you're being, you know, bred into it. And I think the idea of like you stumbling on like the idea of like the mushroom aspect again is like we are like almost like the Matrix type thing. Like we are living on this thing to feed other people, and whether we know it or not. And like, I don't know. Even like, I think mushroom horror is something that I don't know. Like if I was thinking of like that, there's like an episode of Hannibal where the one person is using like a mushroom colony the dead bodies. And then Olescott did one zero where it was like a mushroom fungus that took over this like apartment building. It was fucking like, it's one of the elements of our world that is, again, seems so alien and so like just odd that it exists in our thing. And like, again, how that ties to very much everything else that exists behind us, but we don't even, you know, consider it alien.
Yeah. And I think that the thing that I'm always trying to do is sort of look at comics, you know, on the shelf and sort of just see like, what is no one else doing? What is no one else talking about? What are the subgenres that sort of exist within the space that maybe don't have representation on the shelf, right? Like Lonely Receiver was born specifically out of being like, how do you give a horror romance being like one of the biggest genres of comics, you know, up until pretty much recently. Like if you look at all the Archie stuff, like that's basically romance comics. And there was a long history of that kind of stuff before the Marvel and DC sort of saturated the market in the 90s or whatever. And I just pitched Aftershock. I said, I want to do this and I want to do this. It doesn't exist on the shelf right now. And I think that we can actually speak to people in a way that people aren't right now. And if you look, like, I'm not like tooting my own horn because this sort of stuff takes months to develop, but there are new horror romance books coming out from Heavy Metal, AWA, and Vault. And it's like, coincidence? Maybe, but also they may have saw an opportunity that we saw first. And I think there's really an interesting space. Like, although I was reading The Seeds, and The Seeds has like fungal stuff in it, and I was just like, Innocenti, yes!
He was on top of it, yeah. And I like comics, especially I think now with that, like if they seem to miss, I was just looking at the young adult market, which is like one of, you know, the biggest market in books. And like that is like saturated with horror and thriller and romance, like all those merging together. And like a lot of times not taking cues from things that are, again, like if you look at manga and young adult, I feel like those are the best sellers in the printed world. And like, it's the people who kind of understand like what is working with that. What do people want to read versus like, again, how many more Spider-Man stories do I need to read? Or like,
yeah,
how do I just Spider-Man story do something that's completely different? I don't know. Two things I definitely want to touch on before we finish. Obviously, the strength of this book wouldn't work so much without the amazing art in it. And Annie McDonald is fucking insane, and Triana's coloring. And then I Hassan is who he is, I think, at this point. Like, fuck that guy. He's so fucking good. But how is that? And even working with Jenna on like Lonely Receiver, like being able to kind of translate those almost like high concept images of what you want to work, like how does that relationship work with the art team to really kind of get that again. That's kind of like really what is creating that visceral moment for people. Like, what is the like thought process in relationship to kind of get that onto the page?
Well, I mean, one being I'm a fucking crazy person. So like I do a lot of world building and a lot of like early documentation. So like normally like when I bring a team on, I'll send them like a world building document that's like, here's the year the book takes place. Here's some of the shit that like we need to figure out. Like, here's what, like, for example, I was like, here's what phones look like in this world. Here's what the internet looks like in this world. Here's when it takes place, even though we'll never say it. Here's a whole backstory behind the demon, even though we'll never see it. And sort of just like showing them that I've done the work, but also like showing them sort of the rules of how this world works. So it's like, okay, now we have our box that we're in and we know sort of where the limitations are. We know sort of the history of this space. And then, you know, like in, like as an example, in I Breathe the Body, we go back in these like flashback moments throughout the whole series. And like, it's not until issue 4 that you start to get the context of like what these actually mean and how they kind of fit into one another. You get some in every issue, but like when I presented that to the art team, it was like very streamlined and, you know, chronological sort of like here. And then like, so when they read it in the issue, they're not like, what the fuck is this? Like, where'd this come from? But as a complete, like that was just an aside, I guess, to answer your actual question, like, working with Andy and Triona is honestly like a dream come true. Like, I was such a huge fan of Andy's work on Multiple Man, and I thought it was just so fucking incredible. And then like when, you know, the opportunity came up to work together, I also knew that like the story needed to specifically be tailored for his strengths in terms of like what, how I wrote the horror and what the imagery was, because, you know, in juxtaposition to Jen, whose line work is extremely confident and incredible and the colors are popping, there's some dread that comes from the tension, the emotional tension underneath Jen's art with the colors and everything. But with Andy, because of who he is and the stuff that he's drawn previously, I can get really visceral. I can do things that I may not have been able to do in scripts for Lonely Receiver. So there's a real effort to sort of like, one, just gross Andy out. And then two, to just like keep fucking upping the ante to see what we can get away with in there. And there's so much of that in the book, in terms of just like pushing it further and further and further and further, to the point where like there's some stuff in issue 4 that I had to like draw out because it was so incredibly complex and insane. And so like it's a Hannibal-esque type display, that's all I can really say. And to do that, it has to have like mushrooms mixed in with it, but body parts and all this kind of stuff. And to like work with him on that and be like, this little element's going to be all this crazy shit. It was really cool. And it's like, he's someone who can literally do anything I throw at him. And then Triona, I've just been a fan of for years. We got brief, fleeting moments of being able to work together at Marvel. She colored some of the Age of X-Men stuff, and she colored like a Spider-Man, like one and done that I had written a couple years ago. And so when Andy came onto the book, I knew that Triona would be the perfect fit for sort of the tone. And there's so much of her work has this like almost like stink to it. Like I was like, I want you to be able to smell the book. I want you to have this like rot. And then like, you know, as soon as you turn into page 4 and you go into Silicon Valley, it's different. There's a warmth to it. And then like I said, like, let's make sure it looks like a 70s horror movie was my sort of whole thought process behind it. And like Denis Villeneuve's Enemy was a huge inspiration on sort of the color tone and everything like that. But I, you know, feel like a lot of modern horror is really cold and almost removes a lot of the emotion from it. And Triona and I just talked a lot about like, how do you make this like stinky and gross and like you feel like just slimy from reading it. And I think she nailed it.
Oh yeah. It's, again, kind of, we were looking at the meat page earlier, but again, kind of like being able to kind of color that. So it's, again, it's familiar, but it's unfamiliar, and I don't know. I think people have maybe like Mandy and Color of Space recently have kind of helped that to like kind of bring color back to horror and kind of, again, be able to play with that. Because like, I think, you know, it's like you said, a lot of times there can be a cold aspect to it. I'm trying to like, offhand, but like that can work if that's the tone you're setting. But if not, then like you're completely missing out a whole nother aspect of, again, setting, like it's so important to kind of bring people into that world. And if like you're missing out on color, like, which that is what it does best, kind of establishing that tone, like it's again something completely a whole other level of it you're missing out on.
Yeah, you're just not thinking about the tools in your toolbox, I think, at that point. And I think that there's so much of comics that's so interesting about the whole aspect of, like, you know, having the writer, the artist, the letterer, and the colorist is like each person brings an opportunity to sort of add another dimension to what you're doing. So if you can like run the concert well, everyone's working in tandem with one another in this really interesting way. And like, even, you know, I love working with Haas because Haas will immediately send me an email and be like, how do we communicate tone in the lettering? How do we do something interesting here? And like when he came on to Undone by Blood, that was the first letterer that asked me that question. And it kind of blew my mind. I was like, what do you mean? Like we can have different styles of lettering for shit. And then like that, now I'm like a problem collaborator for him, because I'm always just like, let's do this, let's do that. And there's like, there's even like the, you know, the highlighted words in I Breed the Body, like it's confused a lot of people. There's not a whole lot of like meaning behind it, other than like it's set in a corporate world, so the highlighting felt like it was a good way in lieu of bolding. But there is an aspect to it where like there's certain words that are highlighted that will help you figure out the symbol that's in the early pages. You can actually figure out what that stands for if you pay attention to some of that stuff. But it won't be until the later issues that you can kind of like, you know, build that answer for yourself. And that's something that like I brought to him. I'm like, I'm a crazy person. It's okay if you say no. And he was like, fuck yeah, let's do it. And like that symbol that's in that issue is something that I drew in marker, and then he scanned and cleaned it up. And it's like, yeah. So I lettered one bubble.
Yeah, you don't even need them. I saw, maybe it was last week, he was lettering people talking in the rain. And
yeah, that's from,
had, yeah, that's, yeah, from the rain. Book. Is it? Oh, Jesus Christ. I was like he's fucking ruining it for everybody else. Like, I did an interview with him for Multiversity, and like, I've only been like nervous to do like 3 interviews in my life. And one was him, because like, I don't know the fuck I'm going to ask this guy about comic books. Like, I feel like he knows more than anyone needs to know about at least the complexity of, again, like, who thought, I mean, obviously a lot of letters, but like I think he's taken it to a level where like it's literally becoming like an art form in the way he's approaching it, and fucking insane. And it's so cool to see kind of like that development of what he's been able to do with books.
Yeah, it's the opposite of the conventional thinking, right? Where it's like lettering should be, good lettering is invisible, and it's like, or good lettering adds to the tone of the narrative and adapts to the scene in interesting ways. And it's like working with him has completely reworked my interpretation of lettering. And like, you know, not everyone's favorite thing to get like notes on lettering being like, can we get crazier with it? Like, can we do this? Can we do that? And it's like, he broke me. I'm never going to be the same again. So either we work together until we're dead, or I make everyone else's lives hell.
Right. Yeah. That's the lettering is like the good, not seen. Like, that's just saying like you want an aspect of your book to be average, because like that is like, you know, it's there. I don't need to, you know, it's not bad, but it's not great. Like, that's literally what you're saying by that kind of phrasing. One of the, like, the last thing I think is very important, because again, someone who's worked with Marvel continually coming back to kind of Aftershock, and them being really like, I feel like with them involved, and you've done both, like heavy hitters in the world of horror comics, like what is it with kind of Aftershock what has that relationship been like, and why is that something you kind of continually return to with publisher? And again, at this point, someone who's been published and doing, you know, fairly big X-Men titles at Marvel, like, why is that kind of like the publisher that's been like a really good place for you to put out your kind of, you know, distinct stories where it's just you kind of writing with a team?
I mean, like, the shortest answer is that they just empower me to be me, I think is the easiest way to explain it, is that, like, I feel like sometimes when I pitch things to publishers, I specifically don't want to do things like other books that are on the shelf. I specifically don't technically really want to do things with broad appeal, so to speak. Like, I feel like good comics are made for small audiences and in mind. And, like, if they break out of that small audience, great, cool. But they should be specifically sort of tailored to a certain type of reader. And so, like, when I bring that sort of stuff elsewhere, sometimes it causes a lot of, like, ruffle a lot of feathers, or, like, you get down into, like, details that don't specifically really matter. Like, I pitched something recently and they said, oh, well, the title of this could potentially be misconstrued with this book that we released like 5 years ago. And I was like, I promise you, by the time this comes out, like, no one's going to give a shit about that book from 5 years ago. Like, let's just, you know, it's not a big book, right? It's like, and this also won't be a big book, so they won't be competing for space with one another. But they felt passionately that it needed to change. And then that led to, well, now the title doesn't make sense in reference to this thing in specific, so we need to change this. And it just created this, like, snowball of, like, at a certain point I was like, oh, this is them just kind of corralling me into changing a story into something that they feel like will have a broader or a bigger appeal. And that's not a problem for certain things. And it's, we need art that sort of fills all of these roles. But with Aftershock in particular, I bring them things and I say, this is crazy and this is what I want to do. And they empower me to do it. I think that, like, you know, like Lonely Receiver, spoilers for people who haven't read the whole series, but, like, the fourth issue is like a 20-page orgy. And, like, I pitched that to them and I was like, I want to do like a 20-page orgy scene. And, like, and I said, like, and it ends with like a extraterrestrial entity entering the orgy. And then the last issue is like, our main character is going to fuck that entity. And they were like, okay. Like, and I was like, okay then. All right, great. And, like, I think that was, to me, was really important because it was like, hey, we don't specifically know how you're going to pull this off, but you are passionate about it and you believe in it. And so, like, we'll help you and empower you to do that weird thing. And I think that, like, you know, a lot of the books I've brought them don't fit in nice, neat little boxes, and they, like, back me 100%. And I think that that's why I continue to return to them, because now we just have a rapport where I go, like, here's the next crazy fucking thing. And they're like, right on. And, like, that, like, I feel like I operate in a unique space in terms of their publishing line. And so, like, they get something from me and I get something from them. And so it's, like, just been really beneficial. And then the editorial team is just incredible. Like, they've helped me shape stories. They've pushed me to be a better writer. And, like, realistically, like, you know, the fifth issue of Lonely Receiver is written almost entirely in second person. And I was like, I don't think any other publisher would let me do something like that. And then, like, I'm playing weird narrative tricks and I Breathe the Body. By the time you get to the end, it starts to shift and expand in terms of its narrative consciousness too. And both times they were just like, they empowered me and said, like, how do we help you do this to the best of your ability? And after working with a ton of different publishers, that's not always my experience. A lot of times it's like, how do we kind of keep you corralled? Like, you crazy writer, you're getting, you know, like, you're getting too carried away. And it's like, these are comics, these are supposed to be fun, they're supposed to be explosive and weird and experimental. And, like, you know, I think that's why I enjoyed so much working with Black Mask and Vault. You know, those are publishers that really believe in comics not looking the same or feeling the same. And there's a real, like, undercurrent within comics that's like, everything should just be like highly broad and for everyone. And it's like, but when you make a book for everyone, you actually make it for no one. So long answer to a short question.
Yeah, I see, like, going to another publisher and saying, like, we have this story that takes place current day, well, in the 70s, but also the second half of the story is in a novel, the characters read, like yeah. Okay, but it turns out it's like one of the best books of the fucking year, because, like, again, it's, you tailor it to people who are gonna, like, just eat it up and love it, and, like, other people might stumble into it. It's, again, it's comics. You go into a shop, it's a cool cover, and pick it up. But, like, again, if you tell those stories, I think even, like, it's so weird, because you have the kind of, I don't want to say mediocre, like, but then, like, Marvel would give, you know, the reins to Hickman, who is, like, the most, like, alienating writer in the world, but it's the best fucking stuff. And, like, he's literally someone who, like, writes comic who is, like, actively, like, trolling comics, like, when he was on social media. Like, people fucking love it because, again, it is, like, the, like, I don't know, people want different things, I think. Like, it's, but I understand. Like, it's, you know, it's a big corporation. Like, it's, you know, dangerous to take risks, but, like, people want that shit, and, like, it sells, but, man, I don't know.
Yeah, and I mean, like, the other side of it is that, like, a lot of the big movies and stuff that we consume are relatively safe. They operate by a certain formula at this point. And, like, so when you can take risks and when you can say, trust me to take a risk, like, Hickman's someone who, you know, he landed Secret Wars for them, and, like, and landed, I mean, like, he pulled off probably one of the biggest sort of crossover books the publisher's ever done. And it's a good fucking story. It reads well. It reads well as a single thing, but also as a culmination of his whole body of work. And so when Hickman comes in and says, I'm going to do something fucking crazy with the X-Men, you know, you'd be wise to just get out of the way. And luckily they have. And, like, but if you look at that line, it operates very differently than the rest of Marvel. There are some exceptions, but for the most part, it's this, like, little anomaly that's exists in its own sort of, like, pocket universe that the rest of the publisher hasn't necessarily taken those lessons to heart. And I think that, like, if you look inward, you'd see that that's what people are responding to. And, like, even Future State, right? Like, of what I've read, it's very interesting, and it's very risky. And by taking those risks, it inherently shows me something that I haven't seen before. And, like, that excites me as a reader, especially someone who goes in the shop every Wednesday. And I think that, like, with creator-owned books, if you're not taking risks, how the hell are you going to stand out? How the hell are you going to exist on the shelf next to, like, you know, I can go up toe-to-toe against BKV, but I'm going down, you know? So it's like, I got to give people some fucking crazy thing that they can't get from BKV. And, you know, that's just how my brain works, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, I'm pre-ordering action figures with Krakoan words on them. It's fucking insane that, like, he's literally got, like, you know, the action figure packaging. Because, again, like, that's shit people want, but I don't know.
You feel like you're part of an ing club too,
right? Right. I mean, I don't know what it means. I haven't read any of it because, like, I want it all at once, and, like, I was like, one of the greatest comic experiences I've had is, I mean, same with, like, kind of Morrison's Batman, but, like, reading. I remember reading, you know, Fantastic Four into Secret Warriors into Avengers, and just, like, again, kind of like, having Secret Wars read as this, like, kind of culmination of, like, all this time I've invested in this person and this, like, experience, and, like, his, like, traveling over different titles was, like, so, like, excited. Cause, again, like, I felt like I was part of, you know, that journey, and, like, the company allowed him to do that all. So that's been cool to see. Again, even more reason that they should let you do X-Men horror book. So they came close. Go ahead.
I can't say much, but I do have a fucking crazy horror book at Marvel coming this year at some point. And it's like, this is the first time they've let me, like, I, they came to me and I said, I will do this, but I will only do it if I can do it exactly the way I want to do it. And they were like, fuck yeah. And so it's like, it's crazy balls to the wall horror in the Marvel universe. And I don't know when it will be announced, but no one's expecting it. And I can't wait. That's all I can say.
That's like, what's the, it's the, that brand Marvel, not brand, Bram Revell, X-Men Marvel Knights he did.
Yeah.
It was like, I was so fucking excited. And it kind of like veered at the end away, but like the first like two issues were like X-Men horror. It was great. Tim, I'm assuming the Bruins haven't lost. You haven't quit in anger. you want to do your final question?
Yeah, they did win. I don't know how the Canucks are doing up in Vancouver. I think their game just started.
No sports.
So
me neither.
Zach, gun to your head. If you were forced to write one episode of Two and a Half Men, what would happen?
Let's see. I think I would. I don't know it that well, but let's just riff for a second and pretend that I'll use the actors' names, even though I don't know the other guy's name. There's Charlie Sheen, and then there's, who's the other guy?
Ducky.
John Cryer?
Yeah.
Okay. So the first thing that came to mind was like Charlie Sheen's character doing bath salts, and then slowly skinning himself, removing his skin head to toe, and then John Cryer and his small boy, whatever the boy's name is, they have to work together to bury Charlie Sheen, but Charlie Sheen is resuscitated at 6 feet beneath in the ground, and that's how the little boy learns about death and rebirth. I don't know.
Perfect.
Does that work?
That work. I was gonna say you could do was it Come Into Me was the shared body?
Yeah.
You could literally have Two and a Half Men body.
Yeah, actually it was a failed spec for Two and a Half Men, little known fact.
Yeah. Right. we've adjusted from, we were doing Big Bang Theory last year. We switched to that, but then I realized I know even like less about Two and a Half Men. I know there's Charlie Sheen and there's the Ducky character, and then there was a fat kid and a sassy fat nanny, I think, or I don't know what she was, but.
But the kid got like hot, didn't he? Like he became like, he like had like a growth spurt. Maybe hot is the wrong word, but like he became attractive at a certain point.
Yeah.
That's what he does to you.
That's the problem with kids. Yeah.
Fuck.
Either start like as a fat kid and become attractive, or attractive kid and become a fat adult.
The Haley Joel Osment.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Talk of body horror. What is like? Anyone wants to contact you or yell at you about X-Men, how can they best do that?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Zach B.E. Thompson. That's ZACBETHOMPSON. I also have a newsletter called The Voice in Your Head is Mine. Sign up link on both Twitter and Instagram. That goes out usually every Tuesday, unless I wake up and I'm feeling lazy, and that's every second Tuesday.
Tim, were you in Razor Blades or no? Was that this one?
I was in issue 2.
2, okay, yeah. Man, I'm so fucking excited for 3. Tim, where can we find you?
Right over at, you can find me watching the Bruins at my house. And I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Tim Madera.
Yep, and then as always with comic book podcasts, you know where we are because you don't stumble on them. But I will mention, just because I think it's the easiest thing to get out. If you go to anchor.fm/pagesandpanels, I guess that's like a good hub for finding all the places you can listen to us or whatever. Or if you're listening to this, we're testing out YouTube, so you can go there. I don't know what it is. We should probably have checked that. And then I think, yeah, if you're listening to this, the first episode of another show I'm doing, Is It Too Bad, is out. Be out every Wednesday or so. Me and my childhood best friend are going through every song from the discography of Nickelback, and trying to figure out if they are the worst band in the world. Shit. So hard. I know they. I mean, you're Canadian, so like they're, it's like built into you. He's probably a big
fan. Can confirm worst band in the world.
Yeah. Well, before I started the project, I was like, how many albums could they have? Apparently it's 9. And even more so, they have an EP, which we like recorded the first episode, which was like our like, you know, brief knowledge of what Nickelback is. We were getting like ready to like talk about the first album. Then I discovered they had an EP, so I had to listen to like Nickelback from like 95. I mean, have to. I don't fucking know what I'm doing. Yeah. It's not good. But you can do that. I think it's on, I don't know. It's on my Twitter, at Kyle Overkill, whatever. But more importantly is picking up I Breathe the Body. Number 1 is out if you're listening to this. It will be out next month. You can pre-order it in stores. Like I said, it's fucking, I mean, at this point, if you're sleeping on anything Zach is doing, that's a mistake because it's fucking great.
Thank you.
Yeah, between him and Lonnie, and I know I feel bad, obviously, keeping mentioning that all the time. Obviously, like, you guys both do your own stuff. But the two of you both, what, yeah, and then Israel E by Comics, because I was complimenting everyone who lost. But Tim, you back?
I think I'm back.
Yeah, nope. It's just getting a little laggy, but yeah. Well, thank you.
All right, yeah. All the same. As I was complimenting everyone. No problem. Yes, thanks so much. And that's this episode. And Tim, I promise, I know we're going on a year and a half or so, or however long, but we will cover George Lopez one of these days, I promise. All right, I'll end the broadcast.